You can compare what each gospel writer wrote about Jesus and his ministry in the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for January. It's titled Jesus, A Study of the Words of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Browse before you buy at issuesetc.org or call Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040. Jesus, A Study on the Words of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John costs $14.99. The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for January, Jesus, A Study on the Words of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Here are some words from a holy book of Islam, and I quote, "Believers are not to take disbelievers for friends instead of believers. Whoever does that has nothing to do with God unless it is to protect your own selves against them. God warns you to beware of him. To God is the destiny." What are Muslims being taught by these words? How are they to conduct themselves within the words of the Quran, disbelievers or unbelievers or the infidel? If they are not to befriend them at all, does that mean that all we have is feigned friendships with the Muslims we may know if they believe and apply the words of the Quran? Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're beginning a new series on the doctrines of the Quran. Today, the doctrine of loyalty and enmity. Dr. Adam Francisco joins us, Associate Professor of History and Political Thought at Concordia University, Irvine, California, author of the book Martin Luther and Islam, and co-editor of Making the Case for Christianity. Dr. Francisco, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Hi, Todd.
We often think that Islam is kind of roughly parallel to Christianity in that, like Christianity, it has a large, coherent corpus of doctrine. Is that true?
Well, in one way, no. Muslim theologians will even tell you that Islam doesn't really have a theology. Tariq Ramadan, who for many years was considered the so-called Martin Luther of Islam, taught theology at the University of Oxford, now sits in prison for sexual assault. He wrote a book called Western Muslims and the Future of Islam and makes the point that there really isn't a theology in Islam the way there is in the Christian tradition, with large works attempting to synthesize in a coherent way the teachings of the Bible. At best, in the Islamic tradition, if you have a book that might be considered doctrinal, it would just simply be a listing of Quranic verses. The closest that Islam gets to a systematic theology, if you will, is perhaps their works of what we might call prolegomena, or maybe apologetics. There's quite a long tradition of Muslims trying to demonstrate the veracity of Islam by pointing out, attempting to make cases for the prophethood of Muhammad and waxing eloquent, at least in their mind, on the beauty of the Quran and things like that. But when it comes to extracting from the text certain topics of theology, it's very rare to find a book, an Islamic book like that. There are a few, but they're pretty few and far between.
So this doctrine, for lack of a better word, a doctrine of loyalty and enmity, where is it found?
Well, there are about a half a dozen passages in the Quran, and then there are lots of passages in what's called the Sunnah, you know, another body of literature that's canonical in Islam, but not as important as the Quran. It includes things like biographies of Muhammad's life. Probably the most well-known material in the Sunnah is the Hadith, which are massive volumes that collect everything Muhammad allegedly said and did that didn't make its way into the Quranic text. And you find quite a number of passages in there, Muhammad encouraging, actually commanding Muslims not to take friends among the disbelievers. The Quran is very clear on this, though you can find some passages that seem to contradict it, but at least half a dozen places, the Quran says or enjoins Muslims not to take disbelievers, non-Muslims, as friends, for they're only friends among themselves. And then from that, you get this doctrine, awala walbara, loyalty and enmity, that a Muslim's loyalty and love is to be towards Allah and Allah alone, and they are to hate and despise everything that Allah hates and despises. And the Quran is very clear hates disbelievers, because in the Islamic conception of things, being a non-Muslim is a conscious decision to reject what you, in a way, naturally know about God and the order of creation. And a disbeliever is one who willfully sets themselves up against Allah. And so in a 1.6 billion member community like Islam, there's a wide variety of opinions on this, but at least the traditional doctrine holds that the world is comprised of two classes of people, if you will. You know, there are those who are the believers. They reside within what's called the domain of Islam, where you have a properly ordered Islamic government and Islamic law and so on. And then there is the world outside of that. Muslims can operate in the world outside of the domain of Islam, but at least traditionally or historically, only temporarily in commerce and trade and things like that, unless, of course, the Muslim is struggling in the path of Allah, as the Quran puts it, that is engaging in jihad to expand the reach of the domain of Islam.
So the passage that I'm looking at, believers are not to take disbelievers for friends instead of believers. Let's just deal with that particular clause to begin with. What is being taught there?
Well, that is the classic proof text for this doctrine of loyalty and enmity. And there are lots of ways to talk about it. I mean, the real basic way is that it's encouraging and joining Muslims to always prefer, if they have a choice, Muslims and Islam. Now, if they're in an environment like, for example, America, Muslims in America, traditional Orthodox Muslims, they can, of course, if it's for the sake of Allah, for the success of Islam in America, they can pretend to get along. They can, as the Hadith puts it, they should, in fact, smile amidst the unbelievers, but they should continue to hold the unbelieving world and all unbelievers with disdain. So it's almost, you might say, a bit hierarchical, where this doctrine of loyalty and enemy is always seen in view of what Allah prefers or what Allah's will is, and ultimately what will cause the success of Islam. So I think we've talked about this in previous interviews. There is this doctrine in Islam that's connected to this called taqiyya or kitman, and there are other words for it, that says while you're to hold the unbelieving world and disbelievers with disdain, you should, if it's for the sake of advancing the cause of Islam, which Allah loves, you should at least put up the pretense that you're participating, that you are friendly or allied with even disbelievers.
How is that determination made? When does a Muslim say, I'm going to put forth the pretense of friendship and collegiality, say even in the workplace or something like that, because this will in some way advance Islam?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I guess speaking maybe sociologically, it's really hard to know if you're not a Muslim, you don't really know. That's not to say you can't trust your Muslim friends or anything like that, but the Muslim is traditional, a Sunni Muslim, and they practice Islam. They pray five times a day, perhaps go to mosque on Fridays. If their mosque is Sunni and Orthodox and not progressive or liberal, chances are that determination is going to be there. It will be in practicing taqiyya will be encouraged by the imam or the teachers at the mosque, but the individual Muslim largely determines that for themselves with respect to the, you know, their station in life. The more time you spend around, you know, Muslims in America, the more you'll learn that, you know, they have a wide variety of beliefs on things. But you'll find that the closer you get to some Muslims, if they're honest, the more I hate to say it, but the more you learn that while you might be able to in public be friendly with them, and in private or in terms of their activities behind the scene, they're engaged in all sorts of deception. I speak from experience on that point. You're in Southern California, we've got a large Muslim community from Iranians to Afghans and everybody in between. And the ones, at least in my experience, who are associated with Sunni Islam and are really committed to to learning the tradition of Islam based on the text, not just on some charismatic imam at the local mosque, but an imam who will always point them back to the Quran and the Sunnah, the more they seem to be working with the goal of advancing the cause of Islam, whether it means attempting to convert you or benefit the local Muslim community or anything else they might determine is beneficial for Islam in America. It's really hard to know. But again, you know, you spend time with Muslims, the closer you get to them, you'll find that many of them are just wonderful people, but also some of them you'll always be a little suspicious of what they're really up to.
You mentioned that you speak from personal experience without, you know, betraying any confidences. Give us an example of that scenario.
So here in Orange County, I attend a gym, martial arts gym with my kids, and there's quite a few Muslims that go there. In fact, one of the instructors is a wonderful Muslim man. He's from Iran, Shia, and doesn't really, he always makes comments about how Adam knows more about Islam than he does. But he's just a friendly guy. I trust him. My kids love him. But then there's another man who's very Sunni. He goes to the same gym, he was always kind of preaching at the gym. And he and I have become pretty close in the gym, but there are times where he lets down his guard and tells me about some of the, I don't know how truthful all this is, but he tells me about a lot of the dealings. He's been to jail or prison several times. He tells me about all the dodgy dealings he's been involved in and still practices. So I don't know if it's just a machismo that he's, or this facade of machismo that he's putting up, or if he really is that deceptive in the eyes of like American law. He has said on occasion that here in America, American law that contradicts the law of Islam he's not compelled to obey it. So on another occasion, this man has told me that, I'm going to try to remember exactly what he said, but he said, you know, Adam, I really like you here. You and I are friends, but if we were in a different country, in a Muslim country, if I were to capture you, I would make you my slave. Or if we were fighting, I would cut off your head. So I don't know if it's just my experience, if this is universal for people who spend a lot of time with Muslims, but that's not uncommon, those sorts of conversations with real serious Muslims. When I lived out of Fort Wayne, Indiana, I'd go up to Dearborn, Michigan, not infrequently. And it tended to be the Shia Muslims who were much more open to talking openly about things, whereas the Sunnis, the traditional Sunnis, were much more guarded and always seemed to have an angle in our conversations.
Dr. Adam Francisco is our guest. It's a series we're doing with him on the teachings of the Quran. Today, the doctrine of loyalty and enmity. When we come back, is it connected to the notion that when Islam is in the political minority, it acquiesces, and when in the majority, we see it for what it is?
My plan is to talk about understanding the Ten Commandments through the lens of the passive and the active obedience of Christ.
Pastor Hans Feeney talking about his presentation at the 2020 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
So one of the things I like to do when I teach my confirmation classes, both my youth confirmation and adult confirmation class, is to talk a lot about how it is that Christ fulfills all of these commandments for us and understanding what it means to keep these commandments through the lens of the way that Christ kept them for us from both the perspective of his active obedience, so his active keeping of the law, as well as his passive obedience, which is obeying the will of his Father and going to the cross.
You can meet and hear Pastor Hans Feeney at this year's Making the Case Conference, Friday, June 12th and Saturday, June 13th in Chicago. Learn more and register at issuesetc.org or give us a call, 618-223-8385.
This week on The Word of the Lord Endures Forever, we'll study Jesus washes the disciples' feet. One of you will betray me. A new commandment. Let not your hearts be troubled. and Jesus, the image of the Father. Join me, Pastor Will Wheaton, as we continue our walk through St. John's Gospel on The Word of the Lord Endures Forever, your daily verse-by-verse Bible study on demand at thewordendures.org and on the Lutheran Public Radio app.
Looking for a foreign language program that will revolutionize your students' vocabulary knowledge and their understanding of grammar? How about a program that teaches critical thinking skills, too? Look no further than Memoria Press's Latin curriculum. Students of all ages can use these Latin study programs. Give your students the gift of Latin today. To order, visit memoriapress.com and save $5 on your next order by using the coupon code LPR20. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by becoming an Issues Etc. congregational sponsor. Catalina Lutheran, Tucson, Arizona. Glory of Christ Lutheran, Plymouth, Minnesota. Holy Shepherd Lutheran, Haslett, Texas. Lord of Life Lutheran, Chesterfield, Missouri. Our Redeemer Lutheran, Emmett, Idaho. Redeemer Lutheran, Fairhope, Alabama. St. John Lutheran, Champaign, Illinois. St. Paul Lutheran, Chatfield, Minnesota. Trinity Lutheran, Fredericktown, Missouri, and Zion Lutheran, Gwinner, North Dakota. Find out how your confessional Lutheran church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Just go to issuesetc.org, click Support, Donate, and print the one-page flyer. When your congregation becomes an Issues Etc. sponsor, we'll publicize your church on the radio, at our website, and in the Issues Etc. journal. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're beginning a series on the teachings of the Quran with Dr. Adam Francisco. Today, the doctrine of loyalty and enmity. Dr. Francisco, does this doctrine have anything to do with an observation often made by Dr. John Warwick Montgomery that when Islam is in the political minority, it tends to acquiesce, and when it gains political majority, then its true colors are seen?
Generally speaking, that's what you do see. The Quran itself, as well as the Hadith, suggests, this is kind of summarizing it, that Muslims are enjoined by the Quran to always, as part of their religion, to strive to advance the cause or the cause of Allah, to be engaged in jihad. Now that jihad, that struggle, happens a number of different ways. And in jihad, the Muslim should always calculate the cost. You should always weigh what tact is most appropriate or will bring about the most beneficial result. So my friend that I referred to earlier, who's pretty austere in his Islam, has also said to me on one occasion, he goes, you know, Adam, I could in Islam, everybody says Islam's a religion of peace. That's a bunch of hogwash. I could take you out here in the parking lot and cut off your head. But the reason why I don't do it, or at least one of the reasons why I don't do it, is that we're friends here, but also it would bring all sorts of hardship on the Muslim community in America. In Islamic theories on war, doctrines of war, whether to go to war or not is always decided based on, kind of parallel, I guess, to just war theory, on whether you have a chance at success. And if you don't have a chance at success, it's don't engage in it. Don't lift up your head or make a fuss, but rather wait your time. There are Muslim, influential Muslim figures out there. Yusuf al-Qardawi, he's an Egyptian. I believe he's in Qatar right now, has been for decades, because he's too austere, so he was kicked out of his country. But he's got a big following on Al Jazeera, something like, I want to say last I heard, 10 million, maybe more people regard him as their sheikh, their teacher. And he oftentimes makes issues declarations, almost like fatwas to Muslims living, especially in Europe, and tells them routinely that they should avoid extremism because they have a much better chance for success in just waiting out the, we might call it the demographic war, waiting out the years, perhaps the decades, for when the Muslim population in places like France and and Britain, perhaps even Germany and elsewhere, become so large that they will be able to vote in their politicians and change the law through the means of democracy.
What are we to make of this passage? Quote, "You will find that the people most hostile toward the believers," that is toward Muslims, "are the Jews and the polytheists, and you will find that the nearest in affection toward the believers are those who say we are Christians. That is because among them are priests and monks, and they are not arrogant."
Yes, this verse, it's interesting because it's quoted a lot for in the context of Christian-Muslim discourse to suggest that there's this natural affinity we have for each other. And you know, to be sure, historically, there's lots of cases where Muslims and Christians have debated civilly and engaged in, you know, translation projects together. For example, the Middle Ages, when Aristotle was brought out of Arabic into Latin for good and perhaps for ill as well. So that verse is always used to sort of justify. The interesting thing I find in contemporary Christian-Muslim discourse is how the verses that follow are oftentimes ignored. About three or four verses later, after it explains why Christians are the nearest in affection to Muslims in verse 83, which explains it's because Christians, when they hear the Quran being recited, their eyes well up with tears because they recognize the truth therein. The reason why Christians are the nearest in affection, at least in the context of when the Quran was written, is because Islam believed that Christians were the easiest to convert. You keep reading chapter 5 in the 80s, you find that ultimately the verse you quoted earlier, chapter 3, verse 28, that believers are to not take disbelievers for their friends is reasserted there. So you find these things in the Quran. There are these passages that seem contradictory to other verses, and those are either reconciled by preferring verses in the Quran that come later in Muhammad's career, or if you just read the verses following, it makes a little more sense to reconcile some of those contradictory statements.
I'm trying to think of it from the Muslim's perspective, that apparent contradiction, and simply to say, well, the first one says, don't make friends with them, period. You may feign friendship for expedience's sake, but don't get involved with them, avoid them. And then the second one perhaps saying, you know, the Jews and the polytheists are the worst with respect to this, and the Christians are a little better, but still, verse 3:28 still stands.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And where you'll see this real practically, if you walk into a mixed Muslim crowd, some of them will extend salam to you, assalamu alaikum, and you can respond. Others will look at those Muslims who have extended salam, roughly translated peace in an Islamic way. We could talk about that later, but others will turn their nose up at that because you are not to extend peace to unbelievers. I find this in this gym I go to. The Shia will, you know, we're pretty tight. He'll always greet me with a salamu alaikum. But if this other man is there, he won't, because he knows he gets upset, because the other man knows his Quran much better than the Shia Muslim.
Why, just on that particular vein, why is there such enmity toward Jews in particular among Muslims?
Yeah. Talk about it in two ways. One is the Quran itself is pretty anti-Semitic, not the right word because there's so many connotations for that word, but the Quran says very poignantly in one place that Allah has cursed the Jews such that he's made them into apes and pigs. And there's lots of commentary on what that means. Has he actually turned them into apes and pigs, or are they just sort of the same status before Allah as ape and pigs, the same ontological status? That's usually the preference. In the Hadith, there's a passage speaking of the last days when the Islamic Messiah comes, and in the Islamic tradition, Jesus comes back, and they kind of join forces and they pursue unbelievers around the world. Muslims will join them and pursue Jews, and they will be walking along looking for Jews, and rocks will cry out and say, "Come here, O believer, there's a Jew hiding behind me, come kill him." So you find a lot of these types of passages in the Quranic text. The biography of Muhammad, one of the significant events towards the end of Muhammad's life when he's moved from Mecca to Medina and becomes sort of the central authority in and around that city, is he has to deal with some Jewish tribes that had settled in the city of Medina in decades prior before Muhammad had arrived there. And as the biographies, the authoritative biographies say, that he drives out two of those tribes, but one stays. It's called the Quraiza tribe. And on one occasion, the year that's usually given is around about 627 AD, so about 5 years after Muhammad's moved there. He has all the Jews come out of their homes, and he orders the men to begin digging ditches. And there, you know, the commentaries say they're wondering why they're doing this. And after they're done digging, he lines all the men up on the edge of these ditches. Muhammad forces them to watch their wives and their children enslaved by the Muslims. And then he either himself, one tradition says, and other traditions say he had others do it for him, begins slitting the throats and cutting the heads off that Jewish tribe, and they push him into the ditch or the graves that they had dug for themselves. So you have a lot of textual support for this anti-Judaism. At the same time, you have some major figures in the Islamic tradition, you know, great heroes, if you will, for Muslims, that say it's not Judaism per se that's problematic. Some will go so far as to say that Jewish theology, it's monotheism, it's Unitarian monotheism, it's much more akin to Islamic monotheism, known as Tawhid, than, say, Christianity. And that might be fairly obvious. But the problem with Judaism is, at least from a Quranic and traditional perspective in the Islamic tradition, is that Jews are, like Muslims, prefer each other. They're just as tribal as the Muslims. And they are always going to work to benefit their own community, even if it means being deceptive to Muslims. So they're untrustworthy. Then modern anti-Semitism that you find in throughout much of the Middle East is learned from that whole tradition, to be sure, but also learned from the influence in the little before mid-20th century of National Socialism in places like, you know, some of the major leading Arab countries like Egypt that had alliances with Nazism leading up to World War II.
We're discussing the doctrine of loyalty and enmity in the Quran with Dr. Adam Francisco. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. Dr. Francisco will be a guest during our live broadcast from the 2020 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference. The premier conference for Christian laity is Friday, June 12th and Saturday, June 13th at Concordia University, Chicago. We only have room for 500 attendees. Early bird registration before April 1st is $135 and includes three meals. Find out more and register by giving us a call, 618-223-8385. Or at issuesetc.org, the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, June 12th and 13th in Chicago. When we come back, one more verse from the Quran dealing with this doctrine of loyalty and enmity.
LCMS Rural and Small Town Mission exists to support and encourage congregations in rural and small town settings. In partnership with LCMS districts, RSTM is uniquely positioned to make a major impact in revitalization support, community engagement and outreach training, congregational partnership development, and worker support through providing and developing resources geared specifically to rural and small town congregations. Check us out at lcms.org/RSTM or give us a call at our office. We're here to help.
Preach the gospel at all times. Use words when necessary. I prefer St. Paul, who says, faith comes by hearing and hearing through the word of Christ. And that's what the February issue of the Lutheran Witness is all about, hearing and believing. It includes articles about hearing with your eyes, singing the gospel, listening to the word of God in sermons, and proclaiming the gospel in foreign lands. Visit cph.org/witness to subscribe today. The Lutheran Witness, interpreting the contemporary world from a Lutheran perspective, cph.org/witness.
Essential exercise for the Christian mind. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Augustana Lutheran Church in Moscow, Idaho invites you to receive the gifts of Christ with us. We preach Christ crucified for the forgiveness of your sins, risen from the dead for your justification and life. Confessional, sacramental, liturgical. We're a new Missouri Synod congregation on the Palouse. We meet Sundays near the University of Idaho, 1015 West C Street. Bible study 9 a.m., divine service at 10. Find us on Facebook or visit moscowlutheran.org.
Do you know any military veterans in your church or community? Do you have a passion to support and reach them with the gospel of Jesus Christ? Then Operation Barnabas is for you. Called by Christ's love, Operation Barnabas engages, empowers, and equips LCMS faith communities to provide hope, healing, and support to military-connected persons living in their community. Operation Barnabas is a program of LCMS Ministry to the Armed Forces. Find out more at lcms.org/armedforces.
Welcome back. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. We're beginning a series today with Dr. Adam Francisco about the doctrines of the Quran today, loyalty and enmity. There's one other passage I wanted you to deal with, Dr. Francisco. It's 9:30. The Jews said Ezra is the son of God, and the Christians said the Messiah is the son of God. These are their statements out of their mouths. They emulate statements of those who blasphemed before them. May God assail them. How deceived they are. What's the issue here?
Yeah, so that comes right after 9 verse 29, which is a fairly famous verse because the whole chapter is famous. It's one of the most violent chapters of the Quran. And it's also one of the last, at least from the perspective of Islam, the last bits of revelation given to Muhammad. So it trumps earlier revelations that might contradict it. So at 9 verse 29, Muhammad enjoins Muslims to fight against. And the Arabic used in that passage is qital, similar to the Hebrew qatal, to fight or slay or kill, fight for with the goal of killing. And so you're to fight with the intent on killing people of the book, the Quran says. And that's typically refers to Jews and Christians. Unless they believe in Allah and they prohibit what Allah prohibits and permit what he permits and so on, or they submit to Islam. So chapter 9, verse 30 is in a way kind of a justification for why you should pursue Christians and Jews in jihad. Because the Jews treat Ezra as the son of God, that he's a great hero in their tradition. And the Christians elevate Jesus from a Muslim perspective, a mere human prophet, to the status of being the son of Allah. Doing that is tantamount to what Muslims call shirk, associating created things, whether it's a graven image or a person or an ideology, associating that with perhaps even putting that in conflict with the will of Allah. And that is the unforgivable sin and the thing that must be wiped out of any human society, at least from the perspective of traditional Islam. And so as the verse goes on, it says, so the Jews say Ezra is the son of God. Christians say that Jesus is the son of God. This is what they say with their mouths. The Arabic goes, Qatalahumullahu, which is pretty strong. You could translate it, may God kill them, or may he forever curse them. Those are at least if you think about the 7th century context where Muhammad's working, and most of the context of Islam as expands westward, primary people they encounter are Christians and some small Jewish populations. They become, while they're close in affection, so to speak, because they revere some of the books the Quran refers to, the Torah, the Psalms, and the Gospel, they have so corrupted those books and the message of those books that they too, like the polytheist, need to be fought and pursued until they are either killed or they embrace Islam.
So I think what we see here, given the context of these three passages, and correct me if I'm wrong, is this doctrine of loyalty and enmity does not only extend to the individual Muslim in his personal relations with non-Muslims, but it's part of a tapestry that leads perhaps even to violence.
Oh, sure. Historically, it has. Bernard Lewis, who recently died, maybe about a year ago, he was in his late 90s and is oftentimes regarded as the great docent of Islamic studies in the West. He was the first non-Muslim to be invited into the archives in Turkey to study the Ottoman Empire, knew multiple Islamic languages and so on and so forth. He wrote a piece long ago, back in maybe the late 80s or early 90s, entitled The Roots of Muslim Rage. And he makes the statement that a man named Samuel Huntington in his book The Clash of Civilizations will pick up. He says, Islam has always had bloody borders. And Bernard Lewis, in the corpus of all of his work, he would certainly say, that doesn't mean every Muslim is violent or occasions where Islam has coexisted for a time with non-Islamic entities. But the big arc in history, what you see is Islam is always seeking to, because it's ordered in the Quranic text, it's always seeking to extend its reach politically, legally, theologically, and everything else, however that might be accomplished using the most expedient means.
Dr. Adam Francisco is Associate Professor of History and Political Thought at Concordia University, Irvine, California, author of the book Martin Luther and Islam, and co-editor of Making the Case for Christianity. You can purchase these books at issuesetc.org, click Talk on Demand Archives. Dr. Francisco, thank you again.
Thank you, Todd.
In Hour 2 of Issues, Etc., we're going to be looking forward to Sunday morning according to the one-year lectionary. We're going to be looking forward to the transfiguration of our Lord. Pastor David Peterson will be our guest. We'll be looking at that Matthew account of the transfiguration and all of the attendant propers, including an Old Testament reading where Moses' face is transformed too. Stay tuned.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
Good Shepherd Lutheran Church in Collinsville, Illinois is happy to support the Christ-centered, cross-focused ministry of Issues Etc. Join us for worship, Bible classes, youth ministry, and other opportunities to grow in Christ. We have a Christian day school for children in preschool to eighth grade. We are located at 1300 Beltline Road. Call us at 618-344-3151 or visit www.goodshepherdcollinsville.org.
Hey Todd, what have our listeners noticed first when visiting the LPR studios?
Definitely the small size and the dirt.
Well, not anymore. Thanks to our friends at the Cleaning Authority. They've turned this man cave into a space that meets even our wives' approval.
Whether it's our office or your home, the Cleaning Authority is your cleaning service provider in the St. Louis area.
To schedule a free estimate or to find out more, visit thecleaningauthority.com. Thecleaningauthority.com.
College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois offers ACT, SAT, and PSAT test prep, scholarship application classes, college and career counseling, and more. Hi, this is Lori Konski, president of College Preparation Station. We have helped our students obtain more than $7 million in tuition scholarships in 12 years. Find out more at cpsprep.com. Let us help you create a vision and find your future. The College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois, cpsprep.com.
Did you know that we send out an email each week that details upcoming show topics? It's available for you to include in your weekly church bulletin. Just click the Issues Etc. Journal logo at our homepage, issuesetc.org, and sign up to receive the church bulletin blurb. It's an easy way to invite your fellow parishioners to listen to Issues Etc. issuesetc.org. Look for the Issues Etc. Journal logo and register to receive a weekly bulletin paragraph from Issues Etc.
The Holy Trinity addresses three important things for the reader.
Dr. Carl Beckwith talking about his book in the Confessional Lutheran Dogmatics series, The Holy Trinity.
It explains the difficulties we face in confessing the Trinity in our world today. It shows how Scripture carefully and decisively presents the Trinity, and it rehearses the sound pattern of words used by the Church to clarify and defend the witness of Scripture.
Learn more about the Holy Trinity at lutheracademy.com, lutheracademy.com.